now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
You're listening to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're talking about the return of Big Sam. That's right, Allardyce is back in the Premier League at Leeds United with the tough task of trying to keep them in the Premier League. Leicester and Everton play out a relegation thriller. Arsenal keep themselves in the title race before Erling Haaland breaks another record at Manchester City. We'll also be discussing Tottenham's managerial search, Liverpool's win against Fulham, the Women's Champions League, Lionel Messi, and the culmination of the Football League season. This is The Game. Hello and welcome to The Game Podcast. I'm Tom Clark alongside Gregor Robertson, Tom Allnut, and for the first section of the show, Matt Lawton is with us as well. Now, Matt is here to talk about the biggest story of the week, and that is the return of Big Sam. In this season of endless managerial changes, all these interim coaches, I really, really shouldn't be surprised to see Sam Allardyce back in the Premier League, but I'll be honest, guys, I really was. The 68-year-old made a shock return to the top flight as Leeds head coach, replacing Javi Gracia, with the club 17th in the table and terrified about relegation to the Championship. Now, Matt, we were discussing this breaking news story late on Monday. Tell us about Allardyce's return, how it came about, and why you think Leeds made this call.
Look, I think they made it because they're in a, obviously, not just a perilous situation, but because there's an awful lot riding on it beyond Premier League status. That, you know, we believe that this full takeover by the San Francisco 49ers is imminent. But while I'm being told it's not necessarily dependent on their on them being in the top flight, it could clearly have an impact on value, on how much they have to pay, and so on. You know, the fact of the matter is the Premier League is worth in excess of £100 million a year to every club that's in it. So that's why they've done it. They are on the same number of points as the team, one place above them, and the team one place below them, fourth from bottom. It's panic stations, and they've turned, I guess they've been influenced by the impact that Roy Hodgson has had at Crystal Palace, but they've decided to go with somebody that's got vast experience, somebody that's managed over 500 games in the Premier League, was considered at one stage by the Football Association as worthy of being the England manager. And, you know, we look back at Sam's career, he has, for the most part, been very successful, never been given the keys to one of the biggest clubs, but has got an excellent track record, not least in these kind of situations. Having said that, I have to admit, Tom, and yeah, we did, as you say, we spoke about it later on the Sunday when I got the call sitting in a Pizza Express with my wife and children at about, I think it was about 6 o'clock on Monday, that Sam was coming back and had got the Leeds job. I nearly fell off my chair. I nearly choked on my margarita pizza. I didn't see it coming. He's 68, and as I say, while we know that managers are working later into their lives than ever, really, you know, we saw Fergie hit 70. I think Wenger was there or thereabouts, and as I say, Roy just keeps coming back. You know, the eternal Roy Hodgson. I thought Sam was done, but here he is. He was seen full of chat, full of energy, that same charisma that he's always had. Yesterday, Martin Hardy covered the press conference for us, and it's a tough task, Man City this weekend. But if anyone can do it, I think he can.
Yeah, you talked about his vast experience there and some of the ages issues that perhaps people are going to raise. He's joined by Carl Robinson, the former Oxford United manager in the dugout, and he's got Robbie Keane with him as well. But there's one important ally who's missing, isn't there? And I found this a great bit of detail into one of your stories this week.
Yeah, Sammy Lee. It must be the most expensive jury service in history because he's the poor bloke. Again, he was probably wondering whether he'd ever work in football again. He's been sort of Sam's trusted lieutenant over the years. And unfortunately, while we've got to be careful about detail, he was already on jury service. And I believe that a request to the judge to release him was rejected, understandably, if he's already been sworn in, if the case has already started. Then he's in an impossible position. But as I say, like we think Sam is earning, if he keeps them up, in excess of 3 million. I imagine as his number two, it's going to be a few hundred thousand. So I've never done jury service. I do believe there is some sort of remuneration for doing it, but I don't think it's going to match what Sammy would have made had he been the new number two at Leeds United.
Absolutely. Let's hope those free sandwiches and tea and coffee that he gets is a decent compensation. Now, you mentioned that potential bonus there that you were reporting in excess of 3 million if Allardyce keeps them up. And you also mentioned Martin Hardy's piece talking about that bullish mood that Allardyce was in. Yeah. You know him well. You followed his career. Do you think he can do it? I mean, it's chaos at Leeds. Do you think he's the right man to kind of steer the ship?
As I say, I've had the pleasure. I've probably interviewed him over the last 20 years, 20, 30 years, six or seven times. I remember sitting with him in a nice restaurant in Lancashire when he told me he'd to sort of revive the spirits of the dressing room. He'd taken his players toilet seat racing. It was basically these go-karts that were you sat on toilet seats, but they were kind of adapted into go-karts. I remember that was one of his little quirky sort of initiatives. And I've sat with him and had pie and mash in. Next to the old West Ham ground. He has got a personality that I think it would be interesting if he was ever the head of sport at the Times, but I think we'd all quite enjoy it if we ever gave him the role at our place. I can see players responding to him. I think they always do. I've never met a player who didn't like playing for him. And at this stage of the season, it really is about that sort of new manager bounce, isn't it? Gregor would probably be the best qualified to actually explain what that is and what that means. But, and he also, in every interview you ever do with Sam, he always feels like he needs to actually challenge that sort of image he has as this kind of long ball defensive sort of merchant. And actually, he is far more sophisticated than that. In many ways, he was ahead of his time in the sort of approach to sports science and all this sort of stuff that he was doing at Bolton when he was reviving the careers of all these sort of 30-something footballers that he recruited from all over Europe at that time. You know, he's an intelligent man. He's a football man. He understands football. As I say, I said it at the start, there's a reason why England gave him the job. Obviously, it was disastrous and he lasted one game, although he is, we were talking in the office. It's a great quiz question, isn't it? Who was the person that scored the goal in Sam Allardyce's one game as England manager? We got there eventually yesterday. But he's a good manager. It's a good move. I hope it works. It will be a great story. And then what would be interesting, I think, is whether they then decide to say, would you like to stay next season? Because at the moment, this deal, it's like £500,000 for the four games. Huge bonus if he does keep them in the Premier League. But it'd be very interesting to see if he is successful, if they then say, hey, should we have a bit more Allardyce?
Absolutely. Matt Lawton, Times Chief Sports Correspondent, thank you very much for joining us at the Start of the Game podcast. We will talk more about Allardyce shortly. Matt, thanks for joining us.
No worries.
Matt Lawton there giving us the latest and the background on Sam Allardyce's move to Leeds United, and just proof that if you see Matt in a Pizza Express falling off his chair, you know there's a big story coming. Now, Gregor, he threw to you and said about the new manager bounce, but firstly, what do you make of Allardyce's return?
I'm with you guys. I was absolutely gobsmacked. It's like, if this season can't get any weirder, then Big Sam shows up. It just shows that Leeds are completely out of ideas. They're desperate. And they've lurched from Bielsa to Big Sam in the space of a couple of seasons. And everything that's happened since Jesse Marsh's exit as well has just been a disaster. And actually, largely a waste of time and money. And this is the juncture that's brought Leeds to. You know, it's a pretty damning indictment of Victor Orta and Andrea Radrizzani. And Victor Orta, it's basically cost him his job. But look, if you've got no nowhere else to turn. I can see some kind of semblance of logic in it, but I mean, only just. I think because they've already turned to like the backroom staff member. They've already tried to make an appointment with a, you know, someone who's got a bit of Premier League experience in Javi Gracia, who, you know, there's potential for him to possibly go forward in the future as well. Now they're just going for the absolute firefighter, and who knows how it'll end. Some of the words that Sam, Big Sam himself, has used about it being potentially the biggest achievement of his career if he keeps them up. Leeds could lose all their games and stay up.
Yeah, that is true.
They could draw one game and stay up. The teams below them are looking pretty abject, and one win, I think would be enough. So I understand the kind of narrative around it, but this is sort of a symbol of the desperation and sort of absurdity of the Premier League this season, actually, at the bottom end of the table.
Yeah, and you're right about the kind of they could do it, and him talking it up. But that's his right, isn't it? He's been given this shot, and we've talked a lot of the podcast this season about managerial PR moves and things. That's him kind of puffing his chest out and saying, "I'd be the big dog if I keep them up." Because to be fair to him, Manchester City on Saturday, Newcastle the weekend after, then West Ham. Maybe they'll still be in relegation scrap come 21st of May. Allardyce is probably looking at that final game of the season against a rudderless Tottenham at home for that win that could keep them up. Now, we talked about some of the comments in his press conference. Tom, you were at Leeds' game on Sunday for Javi Gracia's final game, and you've also been kind of reading Martin Hardy's reports of Allardyce's press conference. What do you make of it all? And what do you make of those kind of bullish comments from Allardyce comparing himself to Pep Guardiola and Jurgen Klopp?
I love it. I mean, I really think that if I was a player under Allardyce, that's exactly the kind of talk I'd want to hear. I mean, I was at the game on, was it Sunday, against Bournemouth? And afterwards, you know, Javi Gracia was sort of asked, what do you do now? You know, this is a team that looks like, you know, you're on your way down, basically. And I have to say, I mean, Javi Gracia's sort of strengths have never really been in kind of press conference, kind of communication, bullish sort of sound bites. You know, he's a very detail-orientated, technical coach, organises his teams quite well. But, you know, he's probably not the kind of charismatic character who will deliver a line in the presser. But even after the match, you kind of thought, this guy doesn't look like someone who either believes himself that this team can stay up, and he's certainly not the kind of guy who looks like he's going to be transmitting that belief to the players. And just immediately from the press conference yesterday with Allardyce, I just thought, you know, him saying that nobody's ahead of me, you know, not Pep, not Klopp, not Arteta. I just thought, fair play, you know, fair enough. You know, I mean, you want someone like that who comes in and has full confidence in their ability, who's going to inspire some belief in the players, who's going to trigger something, you know, because I was watching Leeds at the weekend and I thought, when you have teams down there and they're kind of fighting for survival, they need some kind of trump card. You know, what is it? Is it they're hard to beat, you know, good defensively? Is it that they've got, you know, a good goal scorer and they score lots of goals? Is it they've got a real togetherness and a fight with the fans? You know, is it they've got an extremely good home record? You know, they need something that they can hold on to in the kind of final stretch. And I looked at Leeds and I thought, they haven't got any of these things. You know, they concede too easily. They're fragile. They don't score enough goals. You know, there's no togetherness. You know, there's no spirit in the club. And you thought, this is definitely a team with the fixtures they have in the last four games. They're on their way down. And so I guess, you know, that I kind of agree with Gregor. I sort of think I can understand. I don't know if logic is the right word, but I can understand the kind
no,
of...
No, it's not. I regret that word.
I can understand the flex to Allardyce, you know, because they have to do something. And in a way, the kind of the failure in this process with Leeds is not in this appointment. It's in the previous, you know, what's happened in the previous, you know, year or so. You know, they haven't evolved this team. You look at the kind of players in the core of the side, you know, Cooper, Ayling, Bamford, you know, they're still kind of relying on the promotion players. That the team hasn't evolved. The signings they brought in, McKennie, for example, it hasn't really worked, hasn't really added anything to the side. And actually, you know, maybe Allardyce can bring something, you know, in these final games. I mean, I think it's absolutely fantastic they're playing Manchester City this weekend. It's just the kind of perfect Allardyce opener, right? Like, I mean, I don't expect them to get anything, but I mean, what a result it would be if they did.
Yeah, I think logic left this Premier League season behind a long, long time ago, didn't it? But you make some excellent points. And this is, you know, something I've mentioned before about Leeds being, as you say, you highlighted it so perfectly, that we don't know what they have that is their unique selling point other than being a bit mad. You know, under Jesse Marsh and under Marcelo Bielsa before that, it was all a bit hectic, and it's remained that way even under Harry Gracia. So I just think at least it gives them a thing. You know, they've got the big man, they've got the main man to try and keep, get them out of this scrap. But I mean, Gregor, do you think you can keep it to one word, or you can give an eloquent sit on the fence answer? Is he going to do it?
Goodness me. Yeah, honestly, it's impossible. I've been seeing it for ages. It's impossible to call. I think he might, yeah. I think he might manage to muster one win. As you say, it could be against Tottenham. It could be that game against West Ham is huge. And West Ham, as you say, they need to, you know, they've got United again this weekend. So they've just played City and then United. And then they've got to find a result as well. And it could become more nervous because that gap could be closed in the meantime. Look, I just want to add this. I completely agree with what Tom's saying. Javi Gracia looked like a defeated man, and they kind of did have to do something. You know, it's normally the point where you turn to someone in the coaching staff. They've already done that. Michael Scubala has already been in and out. It's just extraordinary that this season, some of the people that are sitting in the dugouts, we said this a few weeks ago, and now Big Sam's back alongside Roy Hodgson, alongside Frank Lampard at Chelsea, Dean Smith at Leicester, Ryan Mason. It's gone bonkers. And this is just sort of like the final release of some crazy balloons into the sky.
So I'm not quite sure, in typical Gregor Robertson fashion, whether you actually said whether
they'll
stay
they will,
or
yes.
Not.
Yes, I yes. think they will
now. Yes, Tom, what are you about you?
I would love to see it in a way, but I don't think so. I think their fixtures are tough. And I just think at this point in the season, what can you change? You know, you can't change that much. Maybe you can transform the confidence of the players suddenly, perhaps, you know, deliver some kind of spirit. But I suspect they're going to get hammered by City, and that initial kind of bounce potential will be quite quickly extinguished. And also, you know, I mean, we have to think, is Allardyce the kind of the Allardyce of whatever, 10, 20 years ago? I mean, you know, he obviously lost that kind of no relegation tag with West Brom. And actually, West Brom in that season weren't that difficult to beat. They, you know, they didn't get as many clean sheets as we would kind of expect for an Allardyce team. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised. It's a mad season, and you kind of look at all the teams down there and you think, yeah, they're all going down. So someone's got to stay up, but I think probably not.
Also, all those times where he came in and saved teams, or well, you know, he came in at West Brom before Christmas. Everton was November 2017. Palace was Christmas Eve. Sunderland was in October. So, like, this is very different. And as Tom said, that kind of spell was broken a little bit at West Brom, although I know you referenced COVID playing a big part in that season. But the Premier League's changed, the landscape's changed. You know, Matt, I said, what is the new manager bounce? It's just changing the atmosphere, removing the baggage from the past, a clean slate, and trying to sort of give the team some semblance of confidence and belief. And yes, Sam might be able to do that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's a big point here about the players that Leeds have as well. You know, you talk about a lot of those clubs and you think about his great escapes of the past, the kind of squads that he had in terms of some of the qualities that his teams embody in terms of character, passion, hard work. I don't know whether this Leeds squad and some of the players in it, you know, maybe your Luke Ayling's and some of these players definitely embody that, but I don't know whether maybe in midfield and in attack he's going to find those kind of characters that he wants for a four-game scrap at the bottom. So I'd be slightly inclined to agree with Tom that I think it's a great story. It might happen, I wouldn't be surprised, but I'd also not be surprised to see him get thumped in three of those four games, and Leeds could be in real trouble. But we shall see. Now, as the Allardyce news was developing late on Monday night, there was a huge game at the bottom of the table with Leicester and Everton playing out a cracking 2-2 draw at the King Power Stadium. I don't know about you guys, I was editing on Monday night, and this was one of the games of the season. Bit of an old school cup match, Dominic Calvert-Lewin and Jamie Vardy back in the starting lineups, back in the goals. But it was a tale of two keepers on the night, Jordan Pickford saving a James Maddison penalty, and Leicester's Daniel Everson making a series of fantastic saves to deny a number of Everton players. As I say, Gregor, a bit of an old school ding-dong this. Point not really great for either side. What did you make of it?
Yeah, it was an absolute cracker. It felt like a kind of a playoff semi-final or something. Mm. You know, where it's like there's so much on it, and both teams were acutely aware of that. It's the highest combined XG for a Premier League game this season, 6.8. So that underlines Everton had 23 attempts. When did Everton last have 23 attempts on goal? It was a great game. And Calvert-Lewin's miss from 4 yards out, whatever, when it kind of hit his heel. Maddison's penalty miss. Vardy looking like he's got a bit of a new lease of life. There's hope for both teams. I mean, although Everton were the better side on the night. I think Dean Smith has changed the atmosphere a little bit, and he's put lots of attacking players on the pitch, and Leicester look dangerous. And this was Everton's best performance in a long time, and as I say, they looked a threat going forward. So, yeah, although ultimately a point didn't do a great deal for either, I think both teams will have a bit more kind of confidence and belief that they can stay up after this game.
Yeah, Jordan Pickford stealing the headlines with his water bottle of tricks in terms of where Leicester players were going to put their penalties. We saw on the Sky cameras picking out the James Maddison stay in the centre, 60% chance, and he did exactly that. I've got to say, it was quite fun to see a goalkeeper stand still and save a penalty. It keeps everyone on their toes. But, I mean, for me, watching the game, I was sat there thinking, why on earth is Jamie Vardy not taking this penalty? He looked absolutely brilliant. To be 36, turning 37 next year, one more year left on his Leicester contract. Charlotte Dunker wrote this week about just how important he still is and how brilliant he still is at playing on that shoulder, running in behind. I mean, he was terrifying the Everton defence. Tom, have you been a bit surprised about how little he's been used this season? And would you have been taking the penalty for you?
Well, I thought it was quite sort of instructive what Dean Smith said afterwards. You know, they kind of said, will Maddison still be on penalties next weekend? And he kind of looked down at his shoes and said, let's see how they get on in training this week. Which I basically took as a definitely not. I agree. I mean, it's always easy to say in hindsight, right? Whenever anyone misses a penalty, you always think, why didn't the other guy take it? But in these sort of situations, Vardy is someone I would put my money on. It just kind of looks like it's kind of coming together now for Vardy. I mean, you know, as you said, this season, it's just incredible, really, that his last goal, league goal, was back in October or something, I think. And now he's got, you know, two in two games. It just kind of feels to me that it's written in the stars now that he's going to kind of go on a little mini run and score 4 in 4 or something and kind of keep Leicester up on the last day or something. And you know, when we were talking about Leeds, you know, what are the trump cards? You know, what do they have? I guess, you know, this is a trump card for Leicester, right? They you know, they have suddenly a player with pedigree, with character and the ability to deliver in the pressure moments, you know, and if he's coming into form at this point in the season, then that's a huge, huge boost for Leicester. And I think, in a way, Calvert-Lewin can be something similar for Everton. I mean, I think if Calvert-Lewin had stayed fit, you know, and played, you know, maybe 20 games or 25 games this season for Everton, then I very much doubt they would be in the position they're in as well. So they can, you know, I think both teams can take positives from this match. You know, they might both see it as a bit of a missed opportunity, but equally, you know, a point at the moment is a big thing as well down there. You know, we don't expect it to be kind of 40 points this season to stay up. Actually, the odd point here and there, you know, one win could be enough for any of these teams to kind of pull away. So I don't think it was a bad result for either side. I think they both come out with it with optimism. I think Everton as well, they'll kind of see that missed penalty as a sort of it's funny, isn't it? Sometimes these things, these moments, they kind of dictate the feeling at the end, you know, and that would have been 3-1. Instead, they missed. Everton, you know, get the equaliser and get a point. And I think they come away with it feeling like they've got a point they maybe weren't expecting to get. So I think both sides can kind of go into this weekend's game with a bit of a spring in their step.
Gregor, would you agree with that? Both teams looking at positives and potentially looking like they both might survive?
Yeah, well, look, definitely both teams will not be kind of feeling downhearted after that performance. Like, as I say, I think Everton had the better chances and were probably the better side on the night. I think Dean Smith had admitted as much, but Leicester could easily have scored more goals. And they both are looking like slightly buoyed. And as I say, this was Everton's best performance in quite some time. And Leicester have looked, you know, much improved without getting the points perhaps that they would have hoped against from the games against Leeds and Everton. They were two big opportunities for them, obviously. And, you know, and another, just with a bit of the luck of the draw, it could have possibly been 6 points in these two games because, you know, Vardy came on and scored another goal that was offside. They had chances at the end in that game. And obviously they missed penalty in this one. So they might look back and rue this, but both teams definitely will feel that they're capable of getting the points they need to survive now.
There you go, Leicester and Everton fans. You'd have been a bit downhearted after Monday night's game, thinking 2 points dropped. Here we are at the Game Podcast to tell you, no, it was 1 point gained and you've both got reasons to be cheerful. Now, up next, we'll be talking about action near the top of the table and two other clubs in managerial meltdown. Tuesday night saw Arsenal pick up a morale-boosting 3-1 home win against Chelsea to keep them in the Premier League title race. Goals from Martin Ødegaard and Gabriel Jesus ensuring they got 3 points. But really, for me, I was in the office again editing the late night action, and this game was all about another dismal showing from Chelsea. A sixth straight defeat for Frank Lampard as caretaker boss. He brought back Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. I'm only sad Hugh isn't with us today so we can talk about, oh, turns out he's not the solution. Nine touches, four from kickoff, hooked at half time. Doesn't get much more embarrassing than that. And just when you think the mess at Chelsea can't look any worse, it does, Gregor.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary, isn't it? Kind of been saying for a wee while now, I think this season will go down in history. How a new owner can spend close to £600 million and have such a detrimental detrimental impact on the team. How that's possible is just extraordinary. I was watching this and just kind of struck me that, like, what have Chelsea players had in the past? They've always had power. You know, there's always been a conversation if things have gone wrong, it's the manager who'll get changed. You know, it's easier to do that than to change all the players. And the players have, over an extended period of time, generally won trophies, succeeded. They've had dips, and then a new manager's come in and he's got the best out of them again, and they've gone on to compete. All that's been taken away by the sheer volume of incoming. So there's no one's really safe. Who's safe at Chelsea? Who's a guaranteed starter? Like, there are not many. So, like, it seems that all that kind of authority and power has perhaps been taken away from them. So, yeah, they might change the manager, but that won't change any of their kind of situations. It's like something in the dynamic at that whole club, at that club, has just been changed, kind of perhaps irreparably. It's incredible. And again, Frank Lampard just must be wondering what the hell he was thinking. And you also wonder how big a job it is for the next man too. Like, yes, they'll have a pre-season. They will be able to try and sort the kind of wheat from the chaff and pick who they want to form a kind of core squad. But it's still going to be a pretty uneasy place. A lot of unhappy players. It's not easy to move other players on. It's not easy to get players out on loan if they have to. I don't know. I think Todd Boehly and the ownership have done enormous damage.
I mean, it is really extraordinary. At this stage in the season, as editors, we're often kind of not only talking about the storylines, but making sure that all the readers have got all the information that they need. And one of the most basic ones is tables, fixtures, who's left at the bottom, things like that. And I found myself thinking, if Chelsea had not just two fewer points, they would genuinely be in a relegation scrap now. We would be looking at this form and thinking, what fixtures have they got left? Are they going to manage to stay up here? And I think, as you say, there's an element here where they're doing so much harm to the future prospects of, because if you'd be looking at this as a manager coming in, wouldn't you, and going, actually, I don't fancy this. We've already had that with Julian Nagelsmann. Tom, what do you make of how things are unfolding at Chelsea?
Yeah, I mean, those, whatever it was, 9-10 points that Thomas Tuchel got at the beginning of the season are now looking like pretty invaluable wins, right? I mean, I completely agree. If they were maybe 3 or 4 points worse off, then they'd be right in the battle at the moment. I mean, the basic thing is Chelsea at the moment are the easiest game in the league. You know, I mean, there was some suggestion that Arsenal, you know, Chelsea could possibly be a difficult game for them or whatever. If I was on a dodgy run, you know, and wanting to kind of get confidence back, there'd be no better fixture that I could see on the printer than Chelsea at home at the moment. I mean, it's just a slam dunk easy victory, right? In some ways, I think it's almost reassuring, because I sort of think about football at the moment, you know, and the way that the kind of European game is going, and so much is dictated by massive takeovers, millions of pounds being spent, the kind of gradual separation of the kind of super elite in Europe from the challengers. And actually, it's almost kind of reassuring, and maybe not for Chelsea fans, but for the rest of us, to kind of see that you can't throw 300, 400 million across a couple of windows at a whole sprawl of players, including a couple of World Cup winners or whatever, and just expect to kind of, you know, soar up the table. There's something that kind of proves actually there is still value in good scouting, in good planning, in good coaching. And that if you don't put these things in place, then actually there is a very low bar to where you can fall, you know, and Chelsea are kind of proving that. I also think that, you know, we mentioned Pochettino there and the kind of the job for next season. And there is a sort of general assumption that this is just going to be a line drawn at the end of the season, and that everything will sort of magically be better and the old Chelsea will be back next season. And it is possible that will happen. I guess, you know, if they spend more money in the summer, that they make good sales, etc., it is possible that they'll be right back in the kind of top five again or whatever next season. But I also think that when you're on this kind of run of form, it is difficult to kind of click your fingers and to suddenly breathe confidence back into these players, to kind of develop that winning habit again. This is now a team who have basically just grown used to losing, you know, and after a while, I mean, Gregor will know better than me, but after a while, I think you almost kind of get used to losing and it starts to hurt less. The players start to care less about it. And I wonder if actually Pochettino has got an even bigger job on his hands than perhaps we think he does. I mean, one thing I think, you know, for me covering Spanish football, you know, Barcelona, the lesson there is that, you know, the hardest thing to do is to sell players when everyone knows you need to sell players. Like the idea that they can just kind of shift 10 or 12 players this summer easily for good transfer fees. In my opinion, all the kind of buying clubs are going to know that Chelsea are desperate to trim their squad. You know, I mean, that's not going to be an easy thing to do unless they're prepared to take big losses. I just think this is a difficult job for anyone coming in, you know, and Pochettino likes small, slimline squads. He likes good characters. He doesn't like egos. He likes malleable players who he can kind of bend towards the way he likes to play. And none of those ingredients at the moment are in place at Chelsea. And, you know, he's a very talented coach, very, you know, charismatic and persuasive. And I give a lot of backing to the kind of improvements he can make. But I think it is a really big job to suddenly turn Chelsea from what at the moment is a relegation form team into anything like a Champions League qualifying team next season.
Gregor, what do you make of that point on confidence and the losing habit that Tom just made there?
Look, I don't think anyone gets into a habit of losing and being happy with it. I think that you can lose the winning habit, though. Or it's sort of its power wanes and eventually will disappear. So, like, whatever side that emerges as a sort of starting 11 or a core group of 15, 16 players next season, they won't have that winning habit or that sort of aura that Chelsea have had. They won't have that together because they'll never have played together over a concerted period of time. And when they have, they've been getting pumped. They've been getting beaten quite easily this season. So I agree with that, absolutely. It's not necessarily losing becomes easier. It's just that the thing that Chelsea have had, being a winning machine with kind of, you know, additions, big additions over the years, but like generally, there's not been major overhauls to it. There was in the early days of Abramovich, but it's been a sort of just a gradual process of building an elite winning machine. And that's been kind of torn to shreds this year.
Now, Tom, you mentioned confidence. This was a confident performance from an Arsenal side who've had some struggles of late. I thought it was pretty impressive the way they came out of the blocks. Mikel Arteta, of course, making some changes to his starting lineup. Jakub Kiwior, the 23-year-old Polish defender, getting his first start. I thought he looked pretty solid, although he wasn't up against much, as we mentioned, in the form of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. Gary Jacobs written an excellent profile on Kiwior on the Times site, which you can read now. Tom, do you think this was just a win at all costs for Arsenal, just to kind of break the slump, break the narrative of they're bottling it, keep them in this title hunt?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and they did that. And I think in a way, the only disappointment for them was that they sort of didn't push on at halftime and kind of put in a few more to kind of give the fans a real thrashing to kind of to celebrate. But, you know, listen, the game was dead and everyone knew they were going to stroll to victory. I don't think Arsenal are going to catch City and rein them in now. I don't see that happening. But I do think that it is important that Arsenal finish strongly as well. I think we were saying this the other week that, you know, there is a slight danger that Arsenal's season kind of fizzles and that they kind of finish with a bit of a whimper, you know, and that they kind of get so demoralised by the idea that they sort of threw away the title that they kind of forget to win their last few games. And I think this was an important kind of checkpoint in that they managed to reverse their recent form and get a real good morale-boosting victory. And they kind of remember, you know, the team they were a few weeks ago. I thought Odegaard was excellent again. You know, I mean, we know how good Odegaard can be. I guess the one thing, you know, is that maybe slightly kind of reluctant to sort of shower praise on him, you know, just a week after he had a very disappointing game, you know, against City. And you have to kind of say maybe the kind of next level for Odegaard is to kind of prove his brilliance in those real, real biggest moments against the best team. You know, it's one thing to kind of stroll against Chelsea, who are giving you the space of the park for 90 minutes. But it's another thing to do it when you really, really have to. And, you know, up against kind of Kevin De Bruyne, who really showed what that is to kind of deliver a sort of title winning performance. But, you know, no getting away. Odegaard was fantastic. Arsenal kind of back to their swaggering best here. And I think Arteta will hope that can give them a real boost for the final stretch now.
Like Chelsea, though, another team in desperate need of managerial help and clarity are Tottenham. Tom, you've written in the Times today that the club are interested in Sporting Lisbon coach Ruben Amorim. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that I've heard from sort of Spurs people for a few times, the club are desperate, basically, to avoid the kind of farcical search that happened after Jose Mourinho was sacked in 2021, when obviously they went through basically every available manager in Europe very publicly and ended up with Nuno Espirito Santo. They want to kind of get their ducks in a row this time and be much more thorough and organised about who they like, who is available, who would be interested in the job. And I think Amorim is very much in that kind of category of coaches that they are keen on and that they believe could make a good Spurs coach if Julian Nagelsmann can't be persuaded to take over. You know, the feeling is that Nagelsmann is very much the top choice, but it's going to be complicated to persuade him, you know, for various reasons. One, Tottenham can't really, there's uncertainty around the kind of direction of the club. And Nagelsmann, I think, is understandably hesitant about that, given they haven't got a sporting director at the moment. And two, you know, he's an expensive hire. You know, he was on about 12 million, I think, a year at Bayern, which is not far off what Conte was earning at Spurs. It could be compensation owed to Bayern as well. So there are various kind of hurdles to overcome there. And what happened in 2021 is they also were kind of keen on Nagelsmann. And then when he went to Bayern, they were sort of suddenly, oh, you know, who are we going to get? And they went through all these other people who they ended up not getting. So they're basically putting in place a kind of short list of alternatives. And they've got indication for Amorim that he would be interested at the end of the season. He's obviously done a very good job at Sporting. Took them to the title for the first time, I think, in, you know, 21 years or something in 2019. One of Europe's sort of most up-and-coming coaches, plays a kind of very modern pressing style, has a good record with young players, has a very good relationship with Pedro Porro, for example, still keeps in touch with Porro, who really sees Amorim as a real kind of mentor for him. And I think it would be, you know, it would be one of the coaches that if they get indication that Nagelsmann is not available, he'll be one of those that they would definitely be talking to at the end of the season. So Spurs, I think, after the kind of chaos of Paratici having to resign, now Daniel Levy very much in charge of this process, and they're kind of stepping up the search for Conte's replacement, because obviously they want to make sure they have an appointment as soon as possible in the summer who can direct the kind of the transfer window, direct the pre-season, so they don't have a situation where they're still looking come sort of July, August.
Yeah, lots and lots of work for Tottenham to do ahead of next season. Lots of work for Chelsea to do, of course, but glad to see Arsenal back on track as we enter the final stages of this Premier League season. However, their return to the top of the Premier League table was short-lived. The runaway train that is Manchester City just keeps rolling on, beating West Ham 3-0 on Wednesday night. Goals from Nathan Ake, Phil Foden, and of course, Erling Haaland. Haaland now has 35 Premier League goals for this season. That's a new record, another record. And as Henry Winter reports in the Times this morning, Haaland has 8, maybe 9 games to score 13 goals that will break Dixie Dean's record of 63 in all competitions in one season as a top flight player in England. Gregor, you love a prediction. I know you do. Is he going to do it?
No, but I read somewhere that because he's only played 74% of available minutes in all comps, at his current goal ratio of 1.26 per 90, he would already be on 61 if he'd played all the minutes.
It's Pep's fault.
He should have. It's just insane, isn't it? I mean, we feared it might be insane, but we didn't believe it was going to be quite this ridiculous. just reading some of the numbers, 35 goals from 108 shots. The golden boot tally in the last four seasons has been 23 or under. So, like, it's just a reminder of what, you know, how insane this is. And he scored more goals than 5 Premier League teams. Chelsea, Forest, Wolves, Everton and Southampton on his own. So he's a bit of a freak of nature, isn't he? He's again saw him in his interview afterwards, just so kind of focused, so like, I don't know, he doesn't get carried away by anything. He looked really kind of, I don't know if touched is the right word, but he looked like he enjoyed the fact he got that kind of guard of honour afterwards, which was quite funny. But then he was back to just kind of saying that you know, the focus, he's not thinking about breaking that record, you know, the next record, he's just thinking about Leeds, the next game, and then it'll be the next game after that, and the next one. That's his mindset. Bit of video games in between, train, eat, sleep, score goals. That's his life.
Yeah. I think it's interesting you mentioned that kind of guard of honour. A lot of the discussions I've had with Paul Hurst, and he's written a lot of this season, is about, you know, that persona, that demeanour of Haaland, the kind of relaxed look, very unassuming, not too arrogant. But I think there is definitely, of course, there's the ego there. And I think what City and a lot of the players have done really well, and Guardiola has done, is kind of just made him feel like the absolute goal-scoring machine that he is, and a bit of a god. And so that kind of guard of honour, I thought, was an interesting touch. Now, Tom, I deliberately asked Gregor about Haaland's goal-scoring because I didn't want to give him the credit that a few weeks ago he did say on the Game podcast that he did still have his suspicions that the City juggernaut would come. Do you think we're going to see a City treble unfolding before us this season?
I think it's all on Real Madrid, I think, to prevent it from happening. I guess if we look at it now, you break it kind of down. The Premier League looks, what, 90%? FA Cup, oof, I mean, you know, 70% maybe. You may put them as favourites in that match. And I think the Real Madrid tie, I think, you know, we were saying with Greg the other day, we kind of thought maybe 50-50. So, listen, I think it's very doable. And if City can kind of get a little bit of a lead, even in the Premier League, where they can, you know, rest players a little bit here and there as well, they might be able to get a little bit of advantage on Real Madrid. Although it has to be said, Real Madrid are sort of now in that mode where they're kind of resting players all the time in La Liga because, you know, they can't win the title. So they're very much one track mind for the Champions League. I think they can do it, but I would never bet against Real Madrid in the Champions League, I have to say. They get to this kind of point in the competition, and I think there is a tendency in this country to kind of always think that Real Madrid aren't going to win, and they always do. They always find a way. So I think these things, well, you know, it always comes down to little moments, little bits of luck, you know, players being fit at the right time, injuries can kind of just kick in and maybe a penalty here and there. You know, it comes down to the finest of margins in those kind of games. But it's very much on. I definitely wouldn't rule City out. But I think they'll probably end up winning the Cup and the league. And I think they will just miss out on the Champions League.
Carlo Ancelotti having a big part to play in whether City will win that treble, of course. Now, just very quickly, gents, on the other game on Wednesday night, Liverpool beating Fulham 1-0 to keep alive hopes of a top four finish. Paul Joyce was writing in the Times this morning, which I thought was an interesting point, talking about the front three of Salah, Nunes and Luis Diaz. And he's saying that they've just played 295 minutes together in the league this season. Obviously, Diogo Jota has played a big part in recent weeks, but it's kind of a reminder of the difficulties they've had with getting a settled front three. Obviously, they were so known for Sadio Mane, Roberto Firmino and Salah being such a deadly force. Tom, do you think it's fair that, you know, we're kind of looking at Liverpool this season as a bit of a transition, but these recent games with Diaz back to fitness, Nunes looking a bit sharper, Jota coming off the bench and making an impact, is it a kind of reminder that they're going to come next season and be a lot stronger?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we're sort of talking about how Chelsea kind of transition into next season. I think I sort of see Liverpool in the opposite way. I see this as a team who are just sort of refinding some rhythm now and some confidence, getting players back from injury. And you know, we know that kind of Klopp team, when it was at the peak of its powers, relied so much on that front three, you know, not just in terms of the goal scoring and the creativity, but the press and the setting of the tempo for the whole of the rest of the side and even the fans as well. You know, that was kind of the real thrust of that team came from that front three and the way they worked together and the cohesiveness that they kind of developed by playing each other week in, week out. And Liverpool haven't had that this season. You know, they've been rotating players up top so much. They've had to kind of adjust to injuries all season. And I think having Diaz back, for example, and getting that kind of settled strike force again will make a huge difference for them. I still think the fundamental problem for Liverpool is in midfield. And I think they have to address that this summer. And we now, you know, think they're not going to be getting Jude Bellingham, for example. If that is the case, then, you know, they need to be pretty smart in the transfer market this summer and get in, you know, one or two real top quality central midfielders to kind of just polish up the engine room again, because, you know, all season I just think Liverpool have looked so leggy in midfield. They haven't really been able to kind of assert that energy that they had before, and I think that's going to be the key area for them, and they'll have to do some good business in the summer. And look, I mean, I think Klopp is doing a a good job of just kind of steering them around here. But, you know, obviously it'll be interesting to see how they start next season. I believe that they will be back up in the kind of top places again. But it'll be a different question, you know, if they don't. You know, I think everyone understands that Klopp has a huge amount of credit in the bank. But there aren't many clubs who will give managers two free seasons. You know, he's been given one. And I think if they're not in the kind of, you know, top places, you know, come kind of October, November, then that'll be a real awkward question for Liverpool to have to address. I don't expect that to happen. I think they'll be right back up there. But I think it is going to depend on them doing some decent transfer business this summer.
I think there's still big issues in defence, though. Klopp referenced how pleased he was to get a clean sheet. There have been many of them, and Alisson was jumping for joy in the changing room afterwards. Like, they've been shipping twos and threes and fours and like making it wild, crazy basketball games. And Carlos Vinicius had two really good chances. One, you know, both saved by Alisson. Again, like, they just passed straight through the middle of Liverpool's defence. These are things that you just didn't see happening. Part of that is, we've discussed this, you know, over and over, part of that is to do with how effectively they're pressing, having the legs in midfield to protect, you know, the back line as well. And there's obviously this new sort of hybrid fullback role for Trent Alexander-Arnold, which will need refined. But so, I, you know, there's questions everywhere. And yes, it's great for them to have, to be able to get a front three that they've probably hoped that they would see a lot more of this season on the pitch and playing well together. And, you know, I spoke about Jota in recent weeks too, his return from injury. But there's lots of issues for Liverpool. And, you know, I think it'll take a few signings and a lot of work in the training ground to rectify.
Yeah, I think Tom's right about the midfield. That is going to be the key area to strengthen in the summer. Gregor, I just wanted to finish with a final word on Fulham. Three defeats in a row, currently in 10th. Obviously, that big incident with Alexander Mitrovic at Old Trafford against Manchester United. You know, do we feel that the season is tailing off a little bit, falling apart? I mean, I watched them against Manchester City in that defeat and thought they played quite well. They kind of, you know, gave it a real go, as the cliche goes. But similar to Arsenal, but further down the table, is there a sense that they kind of just need to get a few wins, bit of a morale boosting finish to the season, just so there's not, because it's an amazing finish. If they finish 10th, 11th, whatever, that's an incredible performance for a team that many tip for relegation.
Yeah, I mean, whatever happens between now and the end of the season, it's been an amazing season. Yeah, clearly they would like to finish it, you know, in a positive vein. But I agree with you, they haven't been playing badly. There was a spell around that game against United, you know, before and after it, that was a big wobble. But they have responded quite well, and perhaps not quite had the results of the points return that they deserved. And they played okay in this game too. They had, as I say, Vinicius had two chances. Bobby Cordova-Reed came on and plays one over the bar at the end. They might have got something from this game. So absolutely, they would like to end the season in a positive vein, but it's been an incredible season, and they're just not to be in this relegation tussle is everything for them.
Yeah, huge season for Fulham. Let's hope they can finish with a couple of wins just to keep the fans happy. Now stay with us to finish the show. We'll be talking to Molly Hudson about the Women's Champions League and a final word on two of the great pillars of modern football, Lionel Messi and the Football League.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, up next, we're talking about the other big game at the Emirates this week. Arsenal's women taking on Wolfsburg in the second leg of their Champions League semi-final. Heartbreak for the Arsenal team, losing 3-2 in extra time. Pauline Bremer's goal after 119 minutes of action, knocking them out and denying them a place in the final against Barcelona. Molly Hudson, you were there for us watching the game and reporting on the action. What did you make of the performance from Arsenal? It struck me as heroic and brave, but it did feel a little bit like they were kind of clinging on at moments.
I think for a few months now, Arsenal have just been almost trying to get through every game just because of the ridiculous injury crisis that they've got. And I think on paper, it always looked as though this was going to be an uphill battle. Obviously, Wolfsburg, you know, are a fantastic side, got a lot of experience in the Champions League. But I think having seen that first leg, which was 2-2, Arsenal were 2-0 down, came back to equalise, it really did feel as though everything was just falling into place for Arsenal. And I think, you know, even in the game on Monday, that there were disallowed goals and things that just seemed like they were working out. They just kept Arsenal in it. And they've really adapted the way they play. I think for a lot of the time in that game, they were playing a lot more long ball, essentially, than what you'd see that Arsenal team play. Because for fans that don't watch a lot of the women's team, they play very much how the men's team like to play, really, with that Arsenal DNA of building out from the back. You know, nice possession-based football. But when you've already lost Leah Williamson, your central defender, and Kim Little, your centre midfielder for the rest of the season, it's very hard to do that. So they adapted a lot. I think they fought really well. And then sadly, it was Lotta Wood-Moy, the childhood Arsenal fan, that on the one occasion they were trying to play out from the back, which was a little bit bizarre in the 119th minute, as you say, sort of gifted Wolfsburg the goal in the end. But I think when you sort of look at it in hindsight, I think it was probably just one game too many for them with just the amount of injuries that they've had.
And what was obviously so much made about the record attendance, over 60,000 fans in the Emirates. What was the atmosphere like? Obviously, you've kind of become accustomed to big games and big crowds following the England women's team. What was this atmosphere like for this big game?
I think it was really good. And I think the thing that's so impressive about what Arsenal have done is that it's not really a one-off. I know, obviously, it's the first time they've sold out the Emirates, but they've had three league games there this season and all of them have had over 40,000 in attendance. So I think this was almost the culmination of a project. Obviously, it was ideal that they were still fighting to actually get in the semi-final. You know, the game wasn't over after the first leg, which I know Arsenal was a bit worried about, given how many injuries they've got. So that it all sort of worked as the pinnacle of this sort of project. But I think what was so impressive is everyone that I spoke to that went to that game, quite a lot of, you know, men's football fans that hadn't seen much women's football, all of them said how good the game was, how competitive it was, how nice the atmosphere was, that there wasn't kind of the unpleasant atmosphere that you can get at some men's games. Obviously, there's a higher demographic of families and of women that go to the women's matches. So I don't like saying that's the positive of the occasion when Arsenal have lost, and obviously they'd want to win. But that is the positive going forward, that I think this season has really shown that it's no longer a one-off occasion to have a big game at the Emirates. It's something that they can do regularly and they can make it worthwhile. Arsenal told me that they've made a profit on all the games that they've made there this season. So it's not just a gesture anymore. It's really something that the women deserve.
Yeah, I think the gesture is a good point. It's not a token game where, oh, we're putting on a special friendly and we're going to try and sell out the Emirates. This is a Champions League semi-final, right? This is a big game. And that is where some of those people that you spoke to giving you feedback about the quality of the game and quality of the football they're seeing, those things go hand in hand, don't they? So I definitely thought that was important, that, as you say, it was a real quality performance. The other thing that I found interesting that you talk about, Arsenal stumbling through this season, Laura Wienreuther, another ACL for Arsenal, the fourth player in 6 months to suffer the injury. We also talked about England injuries there as well, with Williamson mentioned. Fran Kirby this week also ruled out of the World Cup, it seems. What do you make of this kind of injury, I want to say epidemic, but that seems to be hitting the women's game at the elite level? Is it the intensity of the games? You know, you've written about ACLs in particular before. What do you make of it?
I think the problem is that the top players are playing too many games, and the players sort of further down the leagues or for lower ranked international teams aren't playing enough games. And I think that's the problem we have at the moment. with the calendar. I mean, you take all the players that you mentioned there, Leah Williamson, Beth Mead, Vivian Miedema, are the other three of the four that are sidelined with ACLs at Arsenal. All of them pretty much have played every game for club and country. Because they play for Arsenal, they've gone to the end of, you know, most club competitions. Because Mead and Williamson play for England, they've gone to the end, obviously, of the European Championships last summer. I think there is a slight problem with the fact that there was very little rotation in that team. But I think, you know, Serena Wiegmann would argue that we should be at a place where you can play six games for a tournament and not suddenly all go down with season-ending injuries. So I think it's a combination of things. We know women are more prone to getting ACL injuries, sadly, for a number of factors, which I think the key thing is that we don't know how the player load at the moment affects that, because although there's been minimal research done in terms of how certain points of the menstrual cycle, the width of women's hips, all of these factors that can affect ACLs and the more likely you are to do them, we don't know how they combine with how many games you play at this intensity, because quite simply, women's players have never played this many games at this intensity ever before. They've never been professionals before. You know, even a decade ago, they wasn't even professional, let alone playing this number of games. So I think that's the issue that we're having at the moment. We just don't know how to really prevent that. And, you know, I suppose it's more difficult for a club like Arsenal, because you have to look internally when you've done 4 in 6 months. We know there's more ACLs in women's football, but that's quite an extreme end of that spectrum. And, you know, I think it's interesting. There's been some little research discussing maybe how changing pitch can affect it too, because three of these ACLs have been done at the Emirates Stadium, which historically, when you saw a lot of these injuries, they'd be at bad women's pitches that were bumpy, you know, it just makes it more likely. But actually there's a little bit of research sort of suggesting moving from one pitch to another that are very different can also have an impact. So, look, I think that sadly the short answer is that we don't know quite a lot at the moment, but it's a huge blow for Arsenal, and England's injury crisis is even more of a blow, arguably, because of how little they've rotated. And you're now looking at three of that starting 11 from the Euros that are definitely ruled out of the tournament. You've got another two in Lucy Bronze and Millie Bright that are injured, currently on crutches, having had smaller knee surgeries. And you've got Ellen White, who has retired. So you're looking at over half of the team that, you know, might not be able to play, which is just insane.
Come on, Mol, you've got to finish on a high note. You can't come on just talk about Arsenal getting knocked out, injuries. I know it's all difficult, but we're still going to win the World Cup though, right? Come on.
Look, Serena Wiegmann has given us nothing but belief in Serena Wiegmann. So we've got to believe she's going to find a solution. She's going to find the next Leah Williamson lurking around the corner somewhere. She's going to find her. She's going to bring her in, and we're going to win the World Cup.
My thanks to Molly Hudson there for joining us. Before we leave you, though, two final issues to discuss. We're going to play to our strength. Tom, as a man who has worked in Spain and followed Spanish football closely, what do you make of the latest story of Lionel Messi's impending departure from Paris Saint-Germain and the scrap that is going to ensue to sign him? Ian Hawkey has written in the Times this morning that a return to Barcelona might suit all parties, but maybe the numbers don't quite add up.
Yeah, I mean, what a surprise that the numbers might not add up for Barcelona. I mean, that has been the case for many years now, but it hasn't stopped them doing lots of other deals. You know, I sort of look at the whole Lionel Messi PSG episode and breathe a kind of sigh of light depression, really. I think it's just been so disappointing, I think, the whole thing, you know. And also slightly inevitable, you know. I really feel like the way he left Barcelona for PSG was disappointing because, you know, he was a player that everyone kind of always will associate with Barcelona. And, you know, it really was all about Barcelona's failings to run the club properly. But equally, you know, you kind of look at Messi and think, you know, why PSG? You know, why do you want to kind of finish your career in this league, you know, with this club? You know, and this kind of whole association with the Qatari project, the Saudi now, you know, as his role as ambassador, it's all just kind of come to a head. And ultimately, I just kind of think, this really doesn't surprise anyone, you know, that it's ended like this, you know. And where next for Messi, I don't know, really. I mean, Barcelona, I think, would love to bring him back. Not everyone at the club is keen on the idea. I think Gian Laporta would like it very much. It would be a huge boost for his kind of PR in terms of his presidency. Xavi, I think, is kind of keen, although he understands that his team will have to kind of adjust to Messi like every team now does. But the question, obviously, is, as Ian Hawkey says, you know, is do the numbers add up? And at the moment, you know, Barca has spent so long trying to basically get the squad down so they can afford to keep the players they have. The idea that they can suddenly bring in Messi, I mean, you know, all the kind of analysts and financial people at La Liga say it's basically impossible. So how they'll make it work, I don't know. I personally think the more realistic and likely thing is that Messi goes somewhere else, you know, whether that's the States or you know, the Middle East or something. That seems to me to be a more likely solution. But in terms of the kind of Messi era at PSG, I think it will always be a little asterisk on his career, in my opinion. I mean, I think everyone will always remember the, you know, the amazing things he did for Barca and Argentina. I'm not saying that, but I do think that it's a shame that he didn't kind of end his club career at the Camp Nou, you know, in front of the Barca fans, you know, scoring a hat-trick against Real Betis or something, you know, instead of missing training in Paris for an ambassadorial role in Saudi. So yeah, sort of light deflation, I guess, but also not surprised.
Now, Gregor, I might have let Tom talk about Lionel Messi, one of the greats to play our game, but we are going to finish with the big one, the huge, huge, colossal, nation era-defining event that takes place this weekend. No, I'm not talking about the coronation of King Charles. I'm talking about the culmination of the Football League season. So many ups and downs still to be decided. What are you going to be keeping an eye out for?
Where to start? I mean, you've got to start with the Championship playoff race. It's just, you always forget what's happened in years gone by, but this seems to be, you know, so many teams and with still with hopes of making the playoffs, the last two places. So we've got Coventry, Millwall, Sunderland, West Brom, and Blackburn. You think Coventry are probably, you know, they're looking strong in fifth, but Sunderland could, in theory, catch them on goal difference. Sunderland go to Preston, who were chasing the playoffs until very recently themselves. West Brom go to Swansea, who were also chasing the playoffs until very recently themselves. Millwall play Blackburn, who, you know, Millwall are seventh, Blackburn are ninth and can overtake them if they win. And Middlesbrough play Coventry. Middlesbrough are secure in the playoffs. And so a very tough time for Coventry as well. So really, like, deciding or having any idea how that one's going to go is impossible. But it's going to be pretty exciting, I think.
Mm. I mean, who do you want to be in? Because, I mean, I look at this as a Football League fan, and I'm going to jump in ahead of you and say, Mark Robins, you've got Coventry. They've got to be in there. I remember seeing Mark Robins manage Coventry in League Two and thinking, what an impressive side he had. Young players, getting a lot out of them. Hard-working, intensity, pressing as well, like quite a lot of the time. You know, we talk about the Premier League, pressing them from the front, etc. He's been fantastic. And I would personally, I'd like to see Millwall in there. They've had a couple of seasons flirting with it. And I mean, Sunderland's a great story. I think for Sunderland fans to be back in the Championship and be back near the top is great. They had their promotion last season. They've had some enjoyment. But yeah, I think, are you in agreement with me?
Yeah, if I was to pick two, I mean, as you say, Coventry, again, were questioning whether they had a home at the start of the season. They were at a huge kind of number of games to catch up on because they couldn't play their home games. What Mark Robins has dealt with is extraordinary, and what he's achieved, as you say, signing young players, often like players who've come out of Premier League academies, nurturing them, and the odd star like Gyökeres up front, incredible. And Millwall have always been knocking on the door under Gary Rowett, and this year they look like they could do it. But as you said, each one is a good story. Sunderland under Tony Mowbray would be a great story. West Brom, even, like, although, you know, where they were when Steve Bruce left and Carlos Corberan came in, it would be a great story. And this is John Dal Thomason's first season in the Championship with Blackburn. They do feel like they've been slightly overachieving, so it would be a surprise for them to get in. But I would agree with you. The two that are there just now, I would love to see in, because they're also... Millwall's best player this season has been Zian Fleming, who they signed from Fortuna Sittard for $1.7 million, and that's their club record signing. So when you're competing against teams with Premier League parachute payments and stuff, that's a great story. And we've also got to point out at the bottom of the table, it's not entirely decided with, you know, Huddersfield. They play Sheffield United tonight, so they could be safe. But if not, they're playing Reading, who are 3 points behind them and 2 goals behind them in goal difference. So again, that's just be everything riding on that one game. So Championship throws up these stories every single year.
Yeah, and plenty of big stories in League One and League Two as well as we come to the end of the season. Now, with those Championship fixtures being on Monday, we are moving the game podcast to Tuesday next week so that we can cover all the action, not only in the Premier League, but at the end of the Football League as well. Gregor, thank you for joining me, Tom Allnutt, Matt Lawton and Molly Hudson as well. We will see you on Tuesday.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.